Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and for the rest of today's show, I'll be speaking with the filmmakers behind the controversial documentary Citizen Coke. The film explores the influence of the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, whose Koch Industries is based in Wichita, Kansas. Please welcome Tia Lesson and Carl Deal to Central Standard. They're joining us from Argo Studios in New York. Hi, guys.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. How about you?
Great. Thanks for having us on, Gina.
Thanks for joining me. Well, so Carl, let's start with you. The title of this film is Citizen Coke, and on some level, yes, it's about the Koch brothers, but the ratio of minutes in the film spent focusing on David and Charles Koch compared to the film entirely, you'd have to acknowledge that relatively little of the film is directly about them. So rather than me try to state what I think it's about, I wonder if you could give a one or two sentence synopsis of your own.
Sure. Well, yeah, you're right. This is definitely Coke light. Not Coke classic, I guess.
Good one.
The film is not an A to Z history of who David and Charles Koch are and what their political activities have been and the evolution of their family's involvement in conservative politics, which is what a lot of folks are interested in these days, and we are too. But Citizen Coke is really a look at what the ground operations look, what the political operations look like. For big political spenders like David and Charles Koch, and we look at it through the lens of what happened in Wisconsin in 2011 and 2012.
What did happen in Wisconsin? Just refresh our listeners' memories there.
Well, you know, the story of our film is the story of three public workers who are all lifelong Republicans who suddenly found them, you know, the economic ground that their families, you know, lived on was being cut out from underneath them by this newly elected Governor Scott Walker, who it turns out was heavily supported by in both his election and also, you know, once he was elected governor by David and Charles Koch, not always with direct campaign contributions, but with a lot of this what we call dark money spending that was freed up after the Citizens United decision, where nonprofits like David and Charles Koch's Americans for Prosperity, which is the 501c4, you know, political group, spend money that influences voters and supports politicians and policies that we think pretty clearly ultimately benefit the bottom line of Koch Industries.
And of course,
so the Citizen Coke, the title could, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be David or Charles Koch. The Citizen Coke could be a Governor Walker or these elected officials all over the country who've been enabled and who owe their careers to big donors.
And of course, David Koch has been quoted as saying that he didn't even know until this whole thing blew up who Scott Walker was. So there's some debate, and we did invite the Koch brothers via email to join us for this conversation. Heard nothing back. So we'll move on, I guess. But what led you to want to tackle this subject? Did you make the film you intended to make, or did things take a somewhat unexpected course?
Well, actually, it turns out that David Koch, through Koch PAC, supported Scott Walker in the 2010 election, midterm elections, and through Americans for Prosperity and through the Republican Governors Association, heaped, you know, millions of dollars to support Scott Walker and his so-called budget reforms. But we didn't start the story there. You know, we actually were curious, frankly, about the turn that this country was taking in 2009, 2010, particularly after the Citizens United decision, which freed up, you know, corporations and billionaires to spend unlimited amounts of money in our elections. It just decimated our campaign finance laws. And we were curious, you know, about what that looked like, you know, in on the ground. And what we discovered and what surprised us was that this was not only a ruling from the Supreme Court that affected federal elections and congressional races and presidential races. It affected governor's races. It affected our state legislature races. And what we discovered was that groups like Americans for Prosperity, funded and founded by Charles and David Koch, were engaged in a state-by-state campaign to essentially dismantle our democracy.
Tia, when you say that you wanted to see what that looked like on the ground, how did you go about collecting your information? Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, look, we're documentary filmmakers, and the, you know, truth is often, you know, stranger than fiction. And we went to where the action was happening. We converged in Wisconsin on the State House at the same time that hundreds of thousands of citizens, of outraged citizens throughout the state of Wisconsin, were surrounding the State House in January of 2011, February of 2011, in protest of Governor Scott Walker's attacks on public employee unions. And these were not just public employee union members that were out there in numbers. They were farmers. They were Republicans and Democrats alike. They were students and teachers. They were sort of outraged because he was not only attacking the unions, but he was sort of betraying Wisconsin's legacy of progressive values, both progressive Republican and progressive Democratic values. And that's where we landed in February 2011.
Well, I noticed that there were, I guess, about three people from Wisconsin who were really characters who emerged, who you focused on. And they were, I think at least two of them were Republicans, but they, so there was representation from both sides of the aisle, but one side of this particular issue. How did you choose those people who you really focused on with those big crowds that you encountered when you went to Wisconsin?
We were drawn to the Republicans because when we arrived in Wisconsin, it was really evident that this was a transpartisan attack. That, you know, what was happening when you attack the collective bargaining rights, when you weaken organized labor in the state, it affects the Republican members as much as the Democrat members. And keep in mind what was happening on a national level is the Tea Party had a lot of traction nationally, and it had huge cheerleaders on Fox News, and so it was a big part of the public consciousness, and there was really a very clear rift developing within the Republican Party, and so we were drawn to these characters for all those reasons. And also, you know, the problem of big money and corroding our democratic values is also a transpartisan issue. So we just thought it would be it was much more interesting for us as filmmakers to look for common ground with people who you know weren't already in our Rolodex, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well,
it was great fun, and it was hugely educational for us. You know, because when you're following a story over months and months and months, you want to be surprised, and you want to be able to convey some of that to your audience.
Well, one of the criticisms I've heard of this movie is that it does have a particular point of view, and that it makes an argument. I've even heard people going out of their way to put the word documentary in quotation marks, which brings me to the question of how you define the word documentary. Is documentary filmmaking a form of journalism? Does it aspire to objectivity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you know, you can put it in quotes. The fact is every piece of journalism, as you know, reflects a point of view of the person who's delivering that information in some way. And when you're making a documentary and you're spending months and months and months on the ground following a story, you're making decisions every second of the day that impact, you know, the outcome of the story, where your point of view is going to is. You're deciding where to point the camera. You're deciding what questions to ask. You're deciding who to talk to, and so I think it's every bit as journalism as writing a column for a daily newspaper. And certainly, I would say that the kinds of documentaries that we make are very truthful and probably much more aligned with traditional journalistic. Maxims than someplace like Fox News would be.
Tia, I'd like to get you weighing in on this.
Well, look, we went into Wisconsin and throughout this filming of this, whether we were in California at the Koch retreat there, fundraising, where they raised tens of millions of dollars to deploy in the 2012 elections, or Washington, D.C., where we interviewed folks who were instrumental in either supporting or opposing the Citizens United ruling, or following Buddy Romer, the Republican presidential candidate, around as he tried to find a place in the debate in the primaries in 2011.
He was a very compelling character in this documentary.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, what we really tried to do, we kept an open mind. We landed in all those places. We didn't know the answers. We had a lot of questions. We really were curious to see how this money was impacting, you know, who gets to run for office and the outcomes of the elections. And we were curious about the fracturing of the Republican Party, which all of us have witnessed around the country. So I think we let our film roll, our cameras roll. And we listened a lot, and I think we were surprised by what we found.
There's a lot that you've mentioned that I want to get back to, but I want to ask our listeners, what about you? Do you think there are two sides to every story? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. And Tia, one of the things that you just mentioned, you talked about Buddy Romer, and remind our listeners who he is.
Buddy Romer is a politician from the state of Louisiana. He was both a governor and a congressman, and a Republican. He spent the last 20 years in the Republican Party, and he ran for the office of president. And his platform was really primarily getting money out of politics, and so he capped all the donations that came into support his campaign at $100 or less. He wouldn't take super PAC money. He wouldn't take corporate money. And he really wanted to clean up the system. And truthfully, like, he didn't have a fighting chance. I mean, he was shut out of the debates by the Republican Party. And we follow him, you know, from campaign stop to campaign stop to see what he does and to see, you know, how he fares in this environment.
I would say there are like three narrative threads in this movie. One is the Citizens United decision, which you've recapped earlier in the show. And one is, I would say there's a chapter on Buddy Romer and his campaign. And then I would also say that the Scott Walker recall in Wisconsin is a chapter. But then there are also these other characters, as I alluded to before. There's mostly Republicans in Wisconsin who feel sort of abandoned by their party. How did you settle? I mean, this is sort of a complex tapestry you're weaving. How did you pick the threads? And how did you go about weaving them together?
First of all, we were interested in looking at sort of the current political environment post Citizens United, which was the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed corporations and, as we later would learn, you know, really enabled the wealthiest Americans to spend unlimited money on politics, on elections. And so what we felt like, we tried to unravel what was behind that decision and what the political maneuvering was behind that decision. And I guess it's pretty clear that there was some form of, and I don't put this in quotes, a vast right-wing conspiracy to empower the wealthiest Americans to have more say in elections. And that's the way it's played out. And we wanted to see how that played out, though, in those first few years. And so each of these other chapters that you identify give us a look at a way that Citizens United is playing out today. And so on the federal elections and with Buddy Romer, you see the super PACs, which are disclosed political spending. If you give money to a super PAC, you got to know that your name is going to be published. And so your people are going to know how you spent your money politically. And enough people did that you know, Buddy Romer didn't have a fighting chance. When you look at the states like Wisconsin, there we saw a lot of dark money coming in, which is the money through groups like Americans for Prosperity.
Does everyone call it dark money?
That's the colloquialism that's pretty commonly used. And the reason it's called dark money is that you don't know the source of that money. These groups are not required to disclose the identities of their donors, even when they spend that money on elections. And it's an unusual loophole in the election law. And, the only restriction is that candidates both with super PACs and with these dark money groups, and you can call them what you want, secret money groups, political nonprofits, or some people like the woman we interviewed, who at the time was the chair of the Federal Election Commission, ideological corporations, right? So these organizations don't have to disclose who's giving them money. So when they spend money, you don't really know who's speaking. And, so the Supreme Court essentially, by saying that corporations are people and have free speech rights, they're not requiring that, you know, that they disclose their identity while they're exercising those rights.
You mentioned the other documentaries the two of you have worked on together. One of those is Trouble the Water. Is that right? After Hurricane Katrina?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that documentary and maybe whether there are some through lines in how you approach these two stories, these major news stories, and in both cases, a little bit after they had sort of left the headlines.
Well, we landed in post-Katrina New Orleans within a few days after the storm and the breaching of the levees. And we ended up following that film, survivors of the storm, who'd been stuck on their rooftops and their attics as the floodwaters filled their streets and their community. And we really paint a picture of a community of people, of vulnerable New Orleans citizens, the elderly and children and the poorest of the city who'd been left behind. The city just hadn't evacuated them, and there are about 100,000 people left behind and thousands who tragically died in the waters in their attics. So we were immersed in that story, and we followed the journey of a couple of survivors over the course of a couple of years, and we were really thinking a lot about the large gap in this country between the haves and the have-nots. And the very, very wealthy, like Charles and David Koch, who have $100 billion between the two of them, making them the richest men in the world. And people like Kimberly and Scott Roberts, who lived on the margins all their lives and were left behind because of the storm. I think we saw in the aftermath of Katrina this incredible national conversation that was opening up about the big gaps in wealth between people like the Kochs and people like the Roberts. And we were curious about the other side of that equation. So that, I think that's what led us to look at the political spending of Charles and David Koch, in particular because their platform, their libertarian ideology is all about eliminating government services, government agencies, government oversight of industry. They want to eliminate corporate taxes. They really want to eliminate our social safety net.
When you were researching for this film, the Koch brothers are from Kansas. Did you come to Kansas as part of that experience?
We actually did come to Kansas. The Koch family is from Kansas. Koch Industries is based in Kansas. Kansas has recently cut taxes that largely benefited the wealthiest in Kansas, cost the state a lot of money. I think they were very much part of the playbook, the Scott Walker playbook that Brownback enacted there in Kansas. And we were curious about that. Carl went to school in Kansas and we have family in Kansas. So
Okay.
It's always a place we love to go.
Well, back to this issue of whether there are two sides to every story. Do you think that there is anything someone could say to you about another point of view that you would consider valid? Like an argument that I've heard is that the Koch brothers give money to things like scientific research and the arts. They recently and that maybe it's easier to see that. Maybe we see that those things as noble when we agree with the agenda that the money's going toward. Is there any chance that someone could say something that would make you think that they're dedication to the political causes and candidates they believe in is in any way noble?
Well, nobility in the Kochs family, I wouldn't use in the same sentence. I think they've dedicated their lives to eliminating government, and absolutely, there's a lot of vacuum that they've created, and they can use their philanthropies to make up the difference and get good big tax write-offs as a result. But they also, you know, use a lot of that money for political spending. And they also get tax write-offs for that. So a lot of their philanthropic donations have major strings attached. Their ideological strings, their political strings, and they use a lot of that money to promote their ideological positions.
When people talk about like the good old days when documentary filmmaking was more objective or neutral or didn't take a side, is that a real period in documentary filmmaking? When people harken back to that, is that because you are documentary filmmakers and you, I'm sure, know the history of the genre. Could you tell us about the history of that relationship between sort of like a neutral position and the art of the documentary?
Yeah, well. Are you suggesting that we're not neutral coming into this?
Well, I don't know how you were coming into it, but I'm just saying that the documentary itself does make a clear argument, and it takes a position, and it seems that a lot of the criticism around it has been, and I'm not talking about my own opinion, right, but that a lot of the criticism right. has been suggesting that that isn't what a documentary is supposed to do. And so I'm wondering, I guess, the history of the genre that... Is that the case that historically documentaries haven't done that?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different genres of documentary filmmaking. There have been for many years. In the 60s, there was a really wonderful breakaway strain where people were sort of aggressively trying to make sure that they were saying something, addressing the important issues of the day. There was also a really amazing breath of fresh air in the artistic development of how documentaries were crafted and put together that wasn't necessarily at that time aligned with, you know, with the social commentary aspect of documentary filmmaking. But those two came together in the 70s. And it's been a very, very consistent trend in documentary filmmaking where filmmakers in the genre have something that they'd like to say, they want to explore, and they want to say something and have an impact on their audience, you know, with respect to social issues and political issues. And I think that's, you know, there's a strain of documentary filmmaking that filmmakers who might believe that you need to never betray an opinion of any kind throughout, and you need to go to great lengths to create the appearance of objectivity in what you present, and which is also kind of a maxim of journalism that I was taught at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And I feel like that's a little less honest than presenting the experience that you've had as a human being, as an artist, and as a journalist, as you're exploring a topic.
And that is something that people talk about now.
And I feel like it's a lot more interesting as well.
Yeah, that idea of kind of, I think they call it a fairness bias, that in attempting to present two sides of every story, sometimes you can present what is actually a bias. Is that something that resonates?
Well, what are the two sides?
An
example here. If you're making a story about money in politics, what are the two sides? People who want money in politics, and that's a tiny percentage of the American public, and people want money out of politics, and I think that's, you know, 87-90% of the American public is sick and tired of all this money that's getting pumped into both political parties. We weren't taking the position of Republicans or Democrats. Frankly, Carl and I are neither. We're independents politically. But we were looking at amplifying the voices of working people, of middle-class Americans, because the voices of these billionaires and these corporate interests have been amplified for decades.
Speaking of...
And they have an overblown voice in our political debates.
Speaking of amplifying those voices, there was one voice who I found particularly compelling, this teacher who had voted for Scott Walker and then was really disappointed. And we really got to know her very intimately. Could you talk a little bit about her as a character, how you got to know her and what you think that what she represented to you?
Yeah, well, Mari Jo she's been teaching in the public school system in Wisconsin for 25 years. She was taking home a salary of $50,000 a year after that amount of time, was labeled one of the quote unquote haves by her governor when he decided that he needed to break the unions and under the guise of balancing the budget. Now, you know, Mari Jo was a lifelong Republican, and one of the things that drew her to the party, aside from the fact that, you know, she'd always been registered as a Republican, was she's a pro-life activist. And it was a very, very difficult emotional journey for her, you know, as a Christian conservative, to come to this realization, you know, that this party that she'd been affiliated with all of her life was betraying some of the core values. And even though, and so she agonized over her decision on what to do. And you don't know what she does in the film, at the end of the film, if she votes, you know, with or against her governor.
Yeah, she says she won't tell you how she's voted. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking about documentary film this morning, and our time is up for this conversation. Tia Lesson, it was great hearing your perspective. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And we're playing at the Tivoli Theater in Kansas City.
And Carl Diehl, great talking to you this morning, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Gina.
To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about efforts to maintain and restore the old barns dotting our landscape. If you have photos of old barns that capture their rustic dignity and humble grace, send them our way. You can email them to social@kcur.org. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it. Stick around for Up to Date next.